the drive home.
Marshall, could you please call our next case for oral argument?
The next case is A180425, State of Minnesota versus Shamar Sahal News.
Thank you.
Close.
What is the correct pronunciation?
Shamar Muse.
Muse. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, we're ready when you are to begin, but take the time you need to get organized. Sure.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chang Lau. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Sharmar K. Muse. In my brief to this court, I raised two issues. Today, I would like to focus the court's attention on the first issue, and time permitting, I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding the second.
First is the instruction issue?
Correct, Your Honor. The issue I would like to focus on today asks this court to decide whether the district court erred by failing to convey to the jury in its accomplice liability instruction that to find Mr. Muse guilty as an accomplice of robbery, the state needed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he aided and abetted in the commission of that crime. The district court did not instruct the jury regarding the state's burden of proof in its accomplice liability instruction, but instead asked the jury to, quote unquote, apply the instruction. This court should hold that the jury instruction therefore violated the Minnesota Supreme Court's holding in State versus McCook, State versus Milton, and those cases following them, and it should reverse Mr. Muse's conviction for aiding and abetting first-degree robbery. In State v. Kelly and State v. Milton, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that, quote, an accomplice liability instruction must explain that the intentionally aiding element requires the jury find beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant knew his alleged accomplice was going to commit a crime and the defendant intended his presence or actions to further the commission of that crime. The accomplice liability instruction that the district court gave in this case failed to meet that standard. Specifically, the instruction did not convey to the jury that before it determined Mr. Muse was an accomplice to robbery, it needed to find beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Muse met the elements of the aider and abetter, elements of aiding and abetting. While the jury was given a general instruction on the state's burden of proof, that general instruction was not enough to satisfy the requirement under State v. Milton and State v. McCook and those cases following them for three reasons.
May I just clarify before you go forward?
Of course,
Your Honor. There was no objection at trial.
There was no objection at trial, but trial counsel did file a motion for a new trial shortly after the verdicts came in under Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure 2603, which we argue preserved the issue such that the harmless error review should apply in this case. Now, the first reason why the general burden of proof instruction that the court gave was insufficient was that the district court told the jury to, quote unquote, apply the accomplice liability instruction to the crimes alleged to determine whether Mr. Muse was an aider and abetter. Now, under State versus McCook, the Supreme Court held that the district court erred by instructing the jury that it needed only to, quote unquote, consider the elements of accomplice liability in deciding whether the defendant was an aider and abetter. Now, the court held that the instruction was error because the jury was required to do more than just consider the elements. It needed to find them beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, just as it was error in McCook for the court to instruct the jury to, quote unquote, consider the elements of accomplice liability, it was error for the court to tell the jury to simply apply that instruction in this case, because the jury didn't just have to apply the instruction. It needed to find each of the elements of accomplice liability beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the second reason why the general burden of proof instruction was insufficient to save the accomplice liability instruction is that under the plain language of Kelly and Milton, District courts must instruct within the accomplice liability instruction that the jury find beyond a reasonable doubt the accused was an aider and abettor. So going back to the language of Milton, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that, quote, an accomplice liability instruction must explain that the intentionally aiding elements require the jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt. So based on the plain reading of the holding in both Kelly and Milton, it appears that the district court need to, within that accomplice liability instruction, inform the jury of its need to find beyond a reasonable doubt each of the aider and abettor elements. And the district court did not do that here. Now, the third reason why the general instruction regarding to the state's burden of proof was insufficient is because it appeared the district court did not refer to the elements of aiding and abetting as elements in its jury instructions. Now, it appears that the court didn't do so because it didn't believe accomplice liability added elements to the crime. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know that we're here to contest that, but it was problematic because the district court clearly stated that to find Mr. Musa guilty, it had to find each of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And then it identified the elements of the crimes as elements, but it did not identify the elements of aiding and abetting or the factors of aiding and abetting as elements. Now, in Milton and Kelly, it's fairly clear the Supreme Court held that in order to find someone guilty as an aider and abettor under the accomplice liability theory, the jury or the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt each of those elements of accomplice liability. Now, for those reasons, there's a significant likelihood that the jury did not understand that in order to convict Mr. Musa as an accomplice, it needed to find the two elements of accomplice liability beyond a reasonable doubt. And there is some evidence in the record to show that there was some confusion about the different standards between finding Mr. Musa as a principal and finding Mr. Musa as an aider and abettor from this conversation that a juror had with defense counsel after the verdicts were returned. And we've already discussed the standard of review.
That's not part of our record, I assume.
Well, it was contained in an affidavit that was filed with the new trial motion following the trial.
There was no Schwartz hearing.
There was no Schwartz hearing. It was just simply testimony from written and sworn testimony from defense counsel with regards to the contents of the conversation. Not saying it's dispositive evidence, but I think there is some indication from that conversation that there was some confusion within the jury. If we look at just what the defense counsel provided in its affidavit. And we've already gone over the standard of review. It is our contention that the more lenient harmless error analysis should apply in this case simply because trial counsel did file a motion for a new trial after the verdicts were returned under 2603, and because this is an issue that touches on constitutional principles, we would argue that this is an error of fundamental law.
Is there authority for your argument that this becomes harmless error standard of review because of the timing of the objection?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
The fact that no objection occurred in the middle of trial, you know, when this was all being discussed between counsel and the trial court, you know, we would normally, of course, be reviewing under a plain
That's
error
correct,
standard.
Your Honor.
So I'm wondering if you have case law that would support your argument that this is converted to harmless error because it was raised in a post-trial motion.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe I've cited those cases in my rebuttal brief.
Okay.
In my reply brief. I believe that one of the cases I cited was this court's opinion in State versus Griffin, which interprets 2603 and when you get that harmless error review rather than plain error review. So it has to be an issue of fundamental law, and if it is, so long as you file the challenge to the instruction under 2603, then you receive that more lenient standard.
So you need
standard.
Both things.
Correct. Excuse me, Your Honor?
You need both fundamental
Correct.
Law
and we are arguing both things occurred. I mean, obviously in this case, the defense attorney in this case made that challenge following trial under 2603, and we are arguing that this is an error of fundamental law because it touches on constitutional principles. That is, it diluted the state's burden of proof, which affected Mr. Moussa's right to a fair trial. So, in summation, we ask that this court review this error under the harmless error review. Now, even if it applies a plain error review, we would argue that the error affected Mr. Moussa's substantial rights. And I'll get into that briefly later. Right now, I'd like to talk about Dawson. So the state filed, I believe a few weeks ago, as supplemental authority, this court's opinion in Dawson. That case is distinguishable from this case. Now, I recognize that the instruction given in Dawson was similar to the instruction given in this case, because it appears the district court read directly from the crim jig in both cases. But I would argue that this specific issue that we're bringing was not squarely before the court in Dawson, simply because the word that was challenged in the jury instruction in Dawson was intentional and intentionally. The argument was that the district court had failed to adequately convey that in order for the jury to find Mr. Moussa was an aider and abettor, it had to find that he intentionally aided and abetted. And that's not what we're arguing here. What we're arguing is that this instruction that the district court gave in our case failed to properly convey to the jury that in order to find him an aider and abettor, the jury needed to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he aided and abetted, rather than just simply applying, as the district court put it, the accomplice liability instruction. Now, finally, I want to talk a little bit about the prejudice portion of our argument. The state cites sort of a list of facts. It actually, in fact, provides a simple list of facts that were presented at trial and argues that the error here was either harmless or did not affect substantial rights because the evidence was sufficient to prove Mr. Moussa's guilt. I would submit that although the evidence that the state had at trial is one factor to consider in prejudice analysis, it is not the sole factor. In fact, the Supreme Court has held that in the past. This court must consider additional factors. One, it should consider the fact that the state presented the case and the evidence showed at most, that Mr. Moussa was an aider and abettor. The state amended its complaint on the day of trial to an aiding and abetting theory, whereas it was initially charging Mr. Moussa as the principal offender. And it, when the court asked before jury instructions were read, it asked the state, are you applying the accomplice liability instruction to all three charges? And the state responded yes in the affirmative. So it's fairly clear that the state presented the case as an aider, under an aider and abettor liability theory. Now, in addition to that, the evidence shows that at most, Mr. Moussa held a knife to Mr. Briseño's neck and someone else took the wallet. Now, in order to commit robbery as the principal, you have to do both things. You have to use threat of force or force to take away some property from another person.
But if the jury concluded that that's what happened, that is that he held a knife to someone's throat while someone else took his property, that's a pretty strong case, isn't it? If that's what the jury believed?
Well, it would still nevertheless, yes, Your Honor. I mean,
it's
a strong case
of aiding and abetting liability, but it's
right.
A very strong case.
Couple things. To be fair, we don't know what the jury thought. And the second thing is...
Well, the jury's verdict reflects that it thought that it believed the state's evidence.
Yes, but the court must remember, too, that the jury acquitted Mr. Moussa of aiding and abetting assault. So there's some indication there, if not strong indication, that the jury believed that Mr. Moussa did not wield the knife. There were three other individuals there. Any of them could have done any of these things.
They might have concluded that he wasn't guilty of aiding and abetting an assault because he wasn't charged with the assault as a principal.
I'm not really sure where that leaves us, Your Honor, other than to say that it just really casts doubt on what the jury found. And so at the end of the day, you know, if there was, in fact, error in the accomplice liability instruction, you know, we really need to be careful about that. If the jury, in fact, found Mr. Moussa was an aider and abettor, and the instruction dilutes the state's burden of proof, then we can necessarily say that it affected the outcome of the case. But we can't say that for certain. I think there are strong indications that that is what happened, and that is what I argue did happen in this case, and that's why I'm asking that this court reverse Mr. Moussa's conviction for first-degree robbery. If the court has no further questions,
thank you, Your Honor. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Linda K. Jenny. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. It's the state's position that there was no plain error in these jury instructions, much less fundamental error. In fact, there was no error at all. The trial court instructed the jury pursuant to CrimJig 4.01, and it did not deviate at all. And appellant's attorney agreed to the instruction. And obviously, this court knows that for plain error to exist, there must be an error. It must be plain. Appellant's substantial rights must be affected. And then, even if all of those three prongs are met, this court may correct the error only if it seriously affects the integrity of judicial proceedings. None of that exists here. Appellant cites no case at all which holds that a trial court should deviate from CrimJig 4.01 and instruct the jury that, apparently, that the CrimJig 4.01 elements must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And in fact, we don't know exactly how the actual instruction that appellant believes the trial court should have given is unclear. I don't know exactly what he wanted the trial court to sua sponte do at trial. The supplemental authority I provided, although it is not precedential, obviously, because it's unpublished, it does have persuasive value. It's an opinion of this court, where this court reviewed a similar objection and held that viewing the instructions as a whole, which is what this court, of course, must do, that when viewing the instructions as a whole, which included a definition of reasonable doubt at the beginning of the trial and an explanation about reasonable doubt when each of the substantive offenses were described, that viewing the instructions as a whole, including the liability for crimes of another instruction, that the jury was in fact instructed that it must find accomplice liability beyond a reasonable doubt. None of the cases cited by appellant speak to this issue. Huber, which was the latest case on this, which is cited by appellant on this point, is a 2016 case. Of course, that's different because in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court found that Milton and Kelly were violated because the two prongs were not from Milton, which are incorporated in 4.01, were not there. And also in Huber, the district court had conflated the instructions, the aiding and abetting instructions, with the substantive crime instructions. And in footnote 3 in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court said district courts do not do that. And of course, this court did not do that. And of course, if this court looks at Milton, Kelly, and McCook, they have nothing to do with what appellant is arguing. I'll be glad to answer any questions you have on those cases. But Milton was the first case from the Minnesota Supreme Court which said you need the two prongs, that the defendant knew a crime was going to be committed and that he intended his presence to facilitate the crime. In Milton, the court affirmed the instruction because it said the error in not including those two points in the instruction was not plain, because that was the first time the court had said this is what you should do. So obviously in this case, even if this court were to sympathize with appellant's position, since there's no case that says this, that the deviation from 4.0 CRIMJIG 4.01 should be as appellant says it should be, it cannot be plain error because it's not plain, because it is not in the case law anywhere. And in addition to that, since there's no error, there's not an error that's plain, obviously, appellant's substantial rights could not have been affected in this case because he was the main actor here. I refer to him as the principal. He's the man who set it up. He's the man who lured the victim to the meeting because he said that he wanted to make things right due to the fact that he had stolen something from him previously. So he wanted to make it up to him, and that is why they met. And then his two accomplices, of course, drove up while the appellant and Mr. Brissino were on the street. The appellant's two accomplices drove up and got out of their car, and part of this is on video, which I believe was Exhibit 3, which I cite in my brief. It might be Exhibit 5. But clearly in this case, Ms. Appellant held the knife to Mr. Brissino's neck while his accomplice removed the wallet from Mr. Brissino's pocket. So he
counsel
is
for appellant suggests that we ought to view that differently because he was acquitted of the assault charge.
And I discussed that in my brief, Your Honor. The difference is this. For assault two, the state had to prove that appellant intentionally inflicted harm, whereas in aggravated robbery, it's just that harm was inflicted. And the testimony was such from the victim, Mr. Pacino, that this robbery was occurring, and appellant said to him, "Don't worry, we just want your money." And the victim said, "It was stupid, but I fought back, and I wound up wrestling on the ground." And that's when he was injured. His pinky finger was almost cut off, and he had some kind of slash to his thigh, and he had some abrasions. So the jury could well have thought that the injuries were not intentionally inflicted by the appellant, but rather they occurred during the struggle. They may have concluded from that evidence that appellant's intent was not to injure Mr. Brissino, but so that is why they acquitted him of that charge. In fact, the evidence supports that decision of this jury. One other thing I'd like to mention is as to, unless this court has other questions about the jury instructions, I'll move on to the second issue, even though appellant did not discuss it. I'd just like to point out that this was immediate episode evidence. It was part of the res gestae, if you will. The reason this crime occurred was because, as I said, this appellant lured this gullible victim to the scene in order to rob him. And the fact that he had stolen from him before was what informed his decision to do so, because this victim, Mr. Brissino, had not reported the prior crime to the police. And Mr. Brissino is a criminal himself, as the testimony showed. So, as the prosecutor argued, Mr. Brissino was actually the perfect victim. That was the state's theory at trial. The state, contrary to a point made in appellant's brief, the state did not argue that the fact that appellant had robbed this victim earlier made it more likely that he was the person who robbed him this time. Rather, the state argued that the fact of the earlier theft was what led to this aggravated robbery. It facilitated, if you will, and this is discussed in Farden and Ridley, which are cited in appellant's reply brief. The prior theft, in effect, facilitated this aggravated robbery because what motivated this appellant to set up this next aggravated robbery. Here, the evidence was that the aggravated robbery was motivated by the earlier theft because Mr. Brasino was the perfect victim. Put another way, the theft facilitated the aggravated robbery because it provided appellant with the motive to set the victim up. And it showed one of the elements of aggravated robbery, of course, which is that appellant knew he was not entitled to the property. It showed his intent, his motive, and so it was properly admitted, and of course it was not objected to. And so again, the plain error analysis would apply. You'd have to, in order to find that there was error, it would have to be error that was plain, that affected his substantial rights, and that impaired the integrity of these judicial proceedings, and it's the state's position that that plain error test has not been met. If this court has no further questions, thank you. And we would ask that appellant's conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lau?
Just briefly, Your Honor.
With regards to opposing counsel's point on the immediate episode exception to Spriegel, I direct the court's attention to State versus Farnan. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case. It talks about how the fact that an hour within two charged offenses was not immediate episode simply because there's no temporal proximity.
But those cases really, the temporal proximity is just one factor, right?
Well, according to Ridley, it appears in interpreting Farden that both factors, both elements need to be present in order for there to be an immediate episode.
But it's sort of a... there's no hard line on what's immediate in temporal proximity.
There isn't. But in Ridley, it was 15 minutes. In Farden, it was too far apart for an hour. Here we have close to 2 weeks. And so we would submit that that's not even close. Now, with regards to the state's point about the crim jig, the crim jigs are not independent sources of authoritative law. And so it does not save the jury instructions here. Now, if we look at both Milton and Kelly, the district court in those cases read straight from the crim jig. And yet, in both cases, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the instruction given in those cases were insufficient, were not adequate.
This instruction, however, was modified following Milton?
It is not the same instruction given in those two cases, Your Honor. But it's nevertheless deficient for the reasons that we've provided here today and in our briefs.
In fact, now, I recall from Huber, isn't there a place in Huber where the district courts are cautioned not to get the aiding and abetting considerations mashed in with
correct.
The elements of the crime? And in other words, district courts have been instructed by the Supreme Court to be careful about that.
Yes, Your Honor. Not to do a hybrid, what's called a hybrid instruction, where the instruction for accomplice liability is read into the elements of the actual offenses. And the court didn't do that here, and we're not challenging that.
Right, but that suggests that maybe the crim jigs are sort of laid
correct.
Out correctly.
Correct. Those are guidelines for the court. They're not, again, independent authoritative pieces of law. Now, the state continues to make this argument that there's nothing in the case law that suggests that district courts have to instruct in accomplice liability instruction that these two elements of aiding and abetting be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but all we have to do is look at the plain language of Kelly. And it states, again, I quote, an accomplice liability instruction must explain that the intentionally aiding element requires the jury find beyond a reasonable doubt the two elements of accomplice liability. So I don't really understand why the state continues to make that argument. I understand that Kelly and Milton don't directly address whether or not there needs to be an instruction on beyond a reasonable doubt, but the plain language is fairly clear. And if we look at McCook, it is very clear that the Supreme Court was holding that the district court need to provide that instruction to the jury that you need to find these two factors beyond a reasonable doubt, not just to consider it, not just to apply the instruction, but you need to find these two elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And the district court simply did not do that here. Now, I don't have the full instruction in McCook. The court told the jury that it could consider the two factors that Milton and Kelly talked about. Presumably McCook, the court also gave a general instruction regarding burden of proof and a definition of beyond a reasonable doubt. And yet, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the instruction given there was insufficient. And so for all those reasons, I would argue and ask this court to hold that the instruction regarding accomplice liability in this case was insufficient. It was harmful. And again, this is an error of fundamental law because the state really provides no reason as to why it isn't and why harmless error should not apply here. It squarely falls under 26.03, which provides an exception to the plain error standard. And so for those reasons, we would ask this court to reverse Mr. Moussa's conviction for first-degree robbery. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Lyle. Thank you, Ms. Jenny. Case has been submitted.